The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 283.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hi, guys. Hope you're well. Welcome to this evening's public live stream for this weekend, Sunday. I'm in Las Vegas, hanging out with the Mastermind Group for the Real Estate Guys podcast and hanging out with my mom a little bit. She lives here in Vegas, so it's always nice to see her. Before we get going, I'd like to remind everyone to check out RebelCapitalistLive.com. That is the live event I'm doing in Houston, January 7th through the 9th. That's Ron Paul, G. Edward Griffin, Chris Cole, Lynn Alden, just to name a few. And we just added my good buddy and everyone's favorite author, Robert Kiyosaki. That's right. Robert Kiyosaki, my good buddy, is going to be at Rebel Capitalist Live 2 as a speaker in Houston, along with Ron Paul, G. Edward Griffin, Lynn Alden, Lynette Zhang, Mark Moss, Chris Cole, Ron Paul, and all your favorites. So check that out at RebelCapitalistLive.com. Okay, let's fire into the questions. We'll see how many rants I go off on today. I'll see if I can stay on topic. George, you always mention market capitalism. No, I mentioned free market capitalism. I get it, but what are minimum regulations that need to be in place? Okay, abuse and private property. All right, so you've got to have private property rights. And that covers a lot, actually, because you think that you yourself, your own body is your own private property. And so therefore, someone cannot commit any physical assault on you. That would be a violation of private property rights. So as long as the local government is there, I kind of fall into the category of Milton Friedman here. And that if you got the government there protecting the borders, or protecting you from, foreign attack, which the United States is extremely unique in the sense that it's very difficult to attack it because we kind of control Canada. So I don't want to even they're no threat. So other than that, you're kind of like an island with the exception of Mexico. So it's kind of tough as far as a physical attack. Compared to if we were like Germany or something like that, it would be much different from just a geography standpoint. But I think that's pretty much, you might have a couple other needs for government. But I think what you need to do is you really need to look at the government spending as a percentage of GDP. Because we can sit here and get philosophical about it and say, well, they should do this. The road should be privatized and or maybe they shouldn't, I don't know. But I think that as long as we're just, you've got you're protecting the country and that's not to say that you're nation building, you're not aggressively going out and conquering other lands, but you're just protecting your own country, for heaven's sakes. And and you're obtaining private property and then some various other laws, but not too many, I think you're going to be doing okay. And to know how well you're doing, again, I think you just look at the government spending as a percentage of GDP. If you go back to 1913 or prior to the Federal Reserve, the government spending was about 3-5% of GDP. Said another way, that private sector output represented 95% of gross domestic product. Now that number is maybe 40%. So government has gone from, let's say, 5% of total spending or total GDP to almost 60%, 60% of total GDP is government spending. So that's what you do not want. That you're going to have massive distortions in the market. It's going to be a huge misallocation of resources. It's going to be just incredible malinvestment. And it's going to make things just worse and worse and worse. And it's going to make the economy as a whole far more inefficient. I mean, by definition. I mean, just think about how dynamic our economy would be right now in the United States if 95% of it was a result of activity in the private sector. 95% compared to 40%. Just think about that, right? How efficient is the government? Rhetorical question, right? Now, the private sector is by no means perfect, but it's a heck of a lot more efficient than and fluid than the public sector, than the government. And so just think if we had that shift from 40% of economic output a result of the private sector to 95%. You know, everyone talks about, you know, how do we get out of a recession, as an example? How do we get out of a downturn, right? The Keynesians just say more government. We just need more government. That's the answer to everything. Well, more government spending, more government spending, as if government spending has no negative consequence. But that's just their answer, where if you actually think it through, usually you come to the conclusion that it's less government interference, less government spending. A great example of this right now, you can just walk out to your local strip mall or your local Staples or your restaurant, and you guys know this, 95% of the businesses, maybe it's a stretch, let's say 60, 70% of the businesses are going to need to have a help wanted sign, or they're going to be hiring, desperately trying to hire workers. And pretty much every place I've gone, in fact, I've got my assistant right now, Adriana, trying to get us dinner reservations for this evening in Las Vegas for a large group, about 20-25. You would think that would be pretty easy. I mean, we're in Vegas, for heaven's sakes. Nope. Almost impossible. Every single place we call, can you handle a group this size? We're sorry, we're understaffed. We're understaffed. We're sorry, we can't handle a group that size. We just don't have the help. This is what my assistant is hearing over and over and over and over and over and over again. So let's set that aside for a moment. We all get that. We've seen that every single day in our real lives. Okay, well, let's also think through the fact that average incomes in the United States as an aggregate total are 8% higher, not lower, higher than they were in 2019. So what we've done is we have a reduced supply for obvious reasons, because of restrictions and we're paying people to stay home. But we haven't reduced demand. In fact, we've increased demand from the standpoint of just, if you just look at demand exclusively from the lens of income. So we've increased possible demand, let's put it that way, but we've decreased supply. So what are all of these businesses doing? Well, these business owners and entrepreneurs and restaurateurs and bar owners and whatnot, they aren't macro guys and gals. They're not connecting the dots that we connect on this channel. The only thing they're doing is seeing an incredible amount of demand. That's all they see. They can't differentiate artificial demand or unsustainable demand from actual fundamental sound sustainable demand as a result of productivity. The restaurateur can't decipher that. The only thing he knows is that he's packed every single night. And if he's packed every single night and it's super hard to find workers, well, what is he going to do? He or she is going to increase the wage and do anything they can to get enough workers in there to satisfy the demand that they currently have, because in their minds, because they're not macro people, they are just assuming that, well, the economy's on fire. I see it on CNBC every day. It has to be on fire because our bookings are packed every single night. You know, we're filled up 2 weeks in advance. So what the restaurateur does is they hire more people than they otherwise would have, and they pay a higher wage. Okay, well, what is that doing? That's taking scarce resources with alternative uses, meaning human capital or human resources, the workers. You're taking them away from doing something else by not only hiring them, but offering them an increased wage. And then you're hiring more workers than you otherwise would have. That is textbook misallocation of resources and malinvestment. Textbook. Because, see, the entrepreneur is making those decisions based on demand from fugazis. Demand that doesn't exist. It's artificial. It's just a result of government spending, or deficit spending, better said, which will really result in a collapse at some point in time. Now, is that collapse going to be a deflationary deleveraging? I don't know. Is it going to be an inflationary deleveraging? Maybe. Probably more likely that it's going to be an inflationary deleveraging. But regardless of what we get, it's going to result in lower real, when you adjust for inflation, lower real economic output. And that is a depression. So a depression isn't just defined by deflation. It can be an inflationary depression. It's really defined by lower and lower economic output. It's from a trend line, but most people look at it from just a baseline of 0%, right? So if GDP goes down in real terms by 1% or 2% or 5%, that's considered a depression, right? Even if the inflation rate is 5% and, nominal GDP is, let's say, 3, right? So this is an economic contraction. That might be a better word. So at some point in time, that is inevitable. Why? Because the economy right now is propped up by funny money and stimmy checks and artificial demand that is unsustainable. Even if the government continues to print the money, this level of demand is still unsustainable, because at some point prices have to go much, much higher, and then the government can't keep up. They can't give you enough UBI to increase the amount of demand, because prices are going up too quickly. So by the time you get the money, your purchasing power has decreased. You see, even if you're getting $2,000 a month, okay, fine. What if prices over the next year go up by 100%, and then prices the next year go up by 100%? Even if you're getting that $2,000 a month, you see, your purchasing power is gradually going down, 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 down from where it was initially. So the government has to give you more and more and more. But what does that do? That exacerbates the inflation. So it's this chicken and egg type thing, where inflation at a certain point is just moving up faster than they can print the money. So in that world, your purchasing power is going down. In other words, demand is going down. So you've got the entrepreneur that hires all of these people that would have found work somewhere else based on productivity, based on the free market. Now all of a sudden they're working for that restaurateur, and then in a year they've got to fire them again, where if they wouldn't have hired him in the first place based on that phony artificial demand, those people would have gone into other forms of work that would have been far more productive and far more sustainable. And another great example of this is the GFC, or prior to the GFC. Look at how many people went into housing. Look at how many real estate agents, people got into real estate as an agent, as an investor, as a construction worker, as a subcontractor that's an electrician, a plumber, a tile guy or gal. Think about all the people that went into the housing business, let's say. All those people lost their job. Not all, but most of those people lost their jobs, right? Where if the government would not have inflated that bubble in the first place, they would not have gone into housing. They would not have, they wouldn't have invested their life savings starting a cement business because the artificial demand never would have been there in the first place. But you see, those entrepreneurs can't tell the difference between phony, artificial, unsustainable demand and actual sustainable demand that comes from solid economic principles and a solid foundation, right? So what ends up happening is by all of these distortions and all of the all these signals that are now completely convoluted and where the entrepreneur can't tell one from another, it creates this environment where the economic distortions, the malinvestment, the misallocation of resources grow. So when eventually you do have that collapse, it is far greater and far worse than it otherwise would be. One more thing I'll say on this question, because I think it's really wise that we think this through. A lot of people think the cerveza sickness, I don't know, I went over this, you know, I've had a lot of interviews this week, so I can't recall if I went over this in an interview or one of my live streams, but regardless, yeah, I think I might have gone over it with Gerald Celente. But anyway, you know, a lot of people think that this last downturn that we had in 2020 was a result of the cerveza sickness. And, oh, well, you know, who could have predicted that? But what they don't understand is, number one, it wasn't caused by the cerveza sickness. It was caused by the government's reaction to the cerveza sickness. That's a lot different. And also, it would imply that the economy was completely sound. And all of a sudden, out of right field, we had this once in a 100-year pandemic that just destroyed everything because the government had no choice but to lock everyone in their house and put them in jail and make people shut down their business and whatnot. But what that ignores is the blatantly obvious fact, pretty much everyone on this live stream, that the economy was extremely unhealthy prior to that.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Remember Repo? September 2019? Remember that? I think you guys do. When repo rates spiked to 10%, that doesn't happen in a healthy global monetary system or a healthy dollar funding market or a healthy economy. We had 0% interest rates for how long? We were doing QE. We had to do, that was basically there on QE 4 or 5 at that time. You don't have to do QE if the economy is fundamentally sound, right? So what happened in March of 2020, that was simply the straw that broke the camel's back. That just exposed how fundamentally unsound the economy was, or how fragile, maybe that's a better way to describe it, how fragile the economy was going back to 2008 and even prior to then. But it really started to go south in during the GFC and the government and central planners' response to the GFC. But how much did GDP go down during the cerveza sickness? It went down by roughly 10%. That's just kind of back of the napkin math. I don't have the chart in front of me, but that's if my memory serves me right. But let's just say that it's 10%. But keep in mind, we had $4 trillion of government deficit spending. So how much would GDP have gone down if we wouldn't have had that $4 trillion in additional deficit spending, because we were at a run rate of about $1 trillion a year in deficits. And again, if our economy was that great, why are we running $1 trillion deficits per year? But on, you know, we ran about a five, when everything was said and done, about a $5 trillion deficit in 2020. So it's just say that we're on a $1 trillion run rate. Now you add an additional $4 trillion to that. So what would GDP have looked like, right? From peak to trough, it would have gone down by 20, 25%. And that's not even including the fact that the stock market would have gone down by 50%. It most likely would not have recovered. The housing market would be crashing right now. And how much would that affect GDP from a negative standpoint? That probably would have taken it down to 30, 35%. I mean, just you're talking about something that is worse than the Great Depression as far as the headline numbers. And you, and again, the pushback there is, oh, well, we had this Cervasa sickness once in a lifetime thing. All right, well, let's go back to 1918 in the United States. What did we have then? We had something called the Spanish flu. And as you guys know, it's not really controversial to say that the Spanish flu was far worse than the Cervasa sickness. Way, 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 way worse. How much did GDP go down by in the United States during the Spanish flu? Any guesses? Basically, 0%. 0%. If you measure it on a per capita basis, maybe -2%, maybe -3%, something like that. But from the charts I've seen, obviously the data wasn't very complete back then, but from the charts that I've seen, GDP pretty much didn't even move. Now, how much government intervention did they have? How many stimmy checks went out during the Spanish flu? Zero. How much artificial demand did the government create that would have distorted the market and created misallocation of resources and the same type of malinvestment we were talking about earlier? How much did they do of that back during the Spanish flu? Zero. So you get my point. This is not the first time that we have had this type of, or an even worse type of, we'll call it Cervasa sickness, right? But it's the first time that we've had a Cervasa sickness and the GDP going down by 10% and going down by, let's call it 20 or 30%, if not for the $4 trillion in deficit spending. So that in and of itself shows you that it really wasn't about the Cervasa sickness. That, again, was just the straw that broke the camel's back. What it really, what 2020 really showed us is how fragile the economy was and how sick and fundamentally unsound the economy was going into 2020. So that's my hope. Oh, I'm sure that's not my last tangent of the day, but that was a very good question. I think it was important that I go into that data because especially the thing with the Spanish flu, I have never seen anyone go into those, into the data and actually compare that to what's happened or what happened in 2020. And, you know, once you look through that, it's kind of a head scratcher as to why no one really talks about that, because I think it's so applicable. And it's obviously it's not an apples to apples comparison, but it's pretty darn close. And so the fact that no one's really digging into that kind of shocks me. But that's why you got me here, because I am digging into those numbers. All right. Question. Hope you chosen where to live outside the. No, Sean, because the world is changing day by day, month by I have no idea what the world is going to look like. I've got my lease in Phoenix. That goes until, I think, through December or January. And so who knows what the world is going to look like then. I would love to try to make some plans, but I think it's just pretty much impossible right now in the world that we live in. I think you've got to just almost kind of take it day by day and go to a place where you can just maximize your freedom short term and just kind of play it by ear. I can tell you one place I will not go is Las Vegas. This place is horrible. Absolutely horrible. It's a complete nightmare here. Not only has this place just gone downhill as far as the clientele, I mean, it is brutal. Even at the Bellagio or some of the nicer hotels, it's just terrible. I mean, it's like, you know, and I don't want to seem as though I'm condescending or egotistical or anything, but when you go to Vegas, you know, you want to get dressed up. You're getting ready for a night on the town, right? You get some people rent a limo, you got the valet, you got champagne, you got cigars, you got craps tables. You know, the guys are suited in Buddha and the ladies are dressed to the nines and everyone's kind of putting their best foot forward. That's what Vegas was. It was like going to, you know, a fine show, or it was kind of that, it had that elegant, that luxury component of it. Now it's basically like walking into Walmart. Actually, it's kind of worse. If you could envision a store that was worse than Walmart, maybe like the Dollar General. And I'm not knocking that store. I'm sure it's great, but walking into a Dollar General, you don't get that high-end feel with the clientele in there. That's basically, if you walked into the Bellagio right now, it would be indistinguishable from walking into a Dollar General in your local, wherever you live, in a, you know, bad part of town in Kansas City or something like that. That's what Vegas has turned into. So I'll never come back here. I'll come back here to visit my mom, to go to the outskirts of town, you know, Red Rock and that area. But as far as going to the Strip, no thanks. No thanks. So when referring to being your, I don't know if I've talked about being your own central bank. Oh, and just one thing one other note that I want to make there. It's not just, you know, the fact that it's a Walmart disguised as a casino. That's what Vegas has become. But also just the mask folks are just, you want to talk about authoritarian. Oh my goodness gracious. I mean, you just can't even step into a place where you know, the people aren't screaming at you to, you know, put a mask. And listen, if you want to wear a mask inside or outside, which most of the people do here in Las Vegas, that's fine. I mean, I could care less. But, you know, I don't want to play your game. I don't want to, you know, if you want to live in this fantasy world that masks actually make a difference outside, or masks somehow make a difference when you're eating in a restaurant and you put them on walking from the table to the bathroom and back, but yet take them off when you're surrounded by a group of people drinking and laughing and eating in a small space, you know, 90% of the time. If you want to live in this illusion that's somehow moving the needle, that's fine. That it's your life, but don't pull me into the illusion, right? I don't need to live in your fantasy world. I'm okay living in reality. And when you come to Las Vegas, you have to live in the Howard Hughes fantasy world of fear over not just the cerveza sickness, but just this. I said on my live stream the other day that it's like going into Whole Foods and they have all this and sustainable that. And people down deep know that really doesn't make too much of a difference. It's just a label, but they pay an extra $2 or $3 for it because it makes them feel good. And that's fine, but don't pull me into your world. Don't make me do that. And it's the same thing here in Las Vegas, right? The only thing that wearing a mask from your dinner table to the bathroom does is just make you feel good, because you're literally doing nothing at all. And I'm not saying that masks don't work. That's a completely different conversation, right? I am saying mask mandates don't work. That's blatantly obvious. But they might work in a laboratory, but in practice, they don't really work. And they definitely don't work when you're not wearing them in a restaurant for 95% of the time, but yet you do when you walk from your table to the bathroom. That does not work. And again, so why do people do it? Why? Because it just makes them feel good. And I'm not playing that game, right? I'm not into doing things just because they make me feel good when they're not based in reality. And that's what you have to deal with non-stop when you are in Las Vegas. So that's the main reason I will not be coming back. But as far as my own central bank, I don't really recall saying that. So I'm not really sure what you're referring to. How do you always manage to be in a good mood doing research and talking about all the topics you cover? Well, Zach, I mean, you got two choices, buddy. You can laugh or cry. So I choose to laugh. But you'll notice that if you go back and watch my videos from 2019 and prior to the Cerveza sickness, even my live streams or even the videos when I was talking about, you know, central bank digital currencies or inflation or deflation, usually I was laughing a lot more. And it's not like I'm in a bad mood now, but I was always kind of in a good mood and rather jovial, if that's the right adjective to use. But now I'm much more a serious, there's more of a sober tone, I think, to my live streams and even to my whiteboard videos. You know, I remember when I used to draw the whiteboard videos, I would be laughing. You know, that's one of the reasons why I came up with the character, your drunk insolvent Uncle Sam, Moody the Millennial, you know, heroin guy, King FU, you know, all of those, even the, when I would make fun of the MMT troll guy or the Bitcoin troll guy, or, you know, I would sit there and do the whiteboard videos, because I draw all those myself. I'd just be laughing. You know, I'd do that just to crack myself up, just to kind of entertain myself. And now I've found that I have to consciously insert those characters, because I'm not laughing anymore when I'm doing the whiteboard videos, because the environment in which we live, I don't think is really a laughing matter. I think that's kind of the point that you're making. Listen, money is, at the end of the day, it's not life and death. When you're sitting there talking about, you know, owning gold or Bitcoin to hedge against inflation, for me, that's a fun topic. You know, sure, there's some things that are messed up with the economic system in the United States, obviously. And that's part of what my channel is about, is pointing out the cracks in the system so you guys can make better financial decisions for the future. You know, it's about building wealth and thriving in a world of out of control central banks and big governments. I think that's more of a light topic, at least it is to me, than what we're dealing with now. And what we're dealing with now is the entire world turning into a totalitarian police state. There's not much, not too many funny things about that. And you know, even when I'm, you know, if I'm doing a whiteboard video that has that topic in there, it just doesn't really seem right to create some sort of stick figure around what's happening in Australia right now, as an example. Or how do you do a stick figure when you're talking about these health passports to keep it YouTube friendly? How do you how do you joke around about that, where we're literally seeing the world turn into some sort of Orwellian nightmare, some sort of dystopian, sci-fi movie? That's really the only thing that comes to mind, or the only thing that I think can describe this accurately. How do you, you know, draw a stick figure to poke fun at that? It's tough. It's tough. So I hope I can go back, Zach. I really do. I hope we get to a point in time where we've got off this road to serfdom and we've retained our freedoms. And we've shown the government that we will not stand for their overreach anymore. We will not be pushed around. And I can go back to just strictly, not strictly, but just talking about entrepreneurship and kind of freedom in a more lighthearted way, and economics and macro and the Fed and repo and all these things. I hope I can go back to that very soon. But right now, I think we are just at a crossroads. And if I don't stand up and talk about this stuff, who's going to do it? And I don't think at any point in American history has it been more important to stand up and fight for freedom than it is today. And so that's why I choose to really focus on these topics that that unfortunately aren't a lot of fun to talk about. But I think it's just critical that we continue to talk about this and people like me continue to talk about this to open up as many people's eyes as possible. Because at the end of the day, the good news, looking at the glass half full, is that there's a lot more of us than there is of them. There's a lot more average Joe and Janes than there are central planners. And you can see the protests in France, in Denmark. You know, I retweeted a video today of the protests that they're doing in front of all of these restaurants in France, where the people are choosing to eat out on the sidewalks, bring their own food, and almost like have a picnic out on the sidewalks in front of these restaurants that are just empty because they've got the passports. They won't let you in unless, you know, the government has told them basically that it's illegal for businesses to serve a certain group in the population. And so you see all these people that would be in the restaurants, but yet they're choosing to just have a picnic like out on the sidewalk. And you can imagine what's going through the restaurateur's mind. You know, they're getting pissed because they know those are all their customers. So at some point, if they continue this, you know, those businesses are going to start going out of business. And you don't think they're going to complain to their local mayor or governor or however the political structure works in France? Absolutely, they're going to complain. And then that politician is going to know that if they don't do something, they're not going to get reelected. And that's when magically the politician will say, oh, yeah, that passport thing, yeah, the science now says that that's not a good idea. And they'll kind of squirm out of it in a way that, you know, doesn't make them look bad. I'm sure they'll figure out some sort of excuse, but only if the people continue to do that. And that's the power and the leverage that we have. It's numbers. You know, that conversation, that private conversation I had with Gerald Celente the other day when we were at Max Kaiser's Bitcoin get-together was all about how the Berlin Wall was taken down. And I think I've discussed that. And, you know, he told me the story that it was basically a group of people going out there to the wall and they just wouldn't leave. And then more and more and more and more and more and more people went out to the wall because they were sick and tired of the tyranny. And it got to the point where there were thousands of people there protesting, if you will, for every one soldier with a gun. And the soldiers looked around and said, wait a minute. It finally dawned on them that they can't shoot anyone. Because if you shoot someone, you're dead. Because you're gonna instigate a riot. And those people are going to freak out. And you're putting your own life in jeopardy. So what did the soldiers do? They set down the guns. Because there were just too many of the Germans there that had had enough. And so that's what we have on our side. And that's why I think it's so important that we open people's eyes. And that's why I'm making such a strong push to stand up and fight for freedom. I haven't really discussed it too much, but I've hired several employees in the United States and I'm flying them out to Phoenix so we can all work under the same roof so that I can set up a proper studio. So you guys will have great audio, but it'll look professional. And I'm doing this because I want to spread the message to people who, I don't want to say haven't been sold yet, but I guess that's kind of the best way to say it, in the sense that all of you on, I mean, there's over 1,000 people on this live stream right now, and all of you, I don't have to sell you on why the Fed is bad. Most of you already fall into that group, and therefore I can sit here, and most of you know me well from my videos, and so I don't need to have a professional setup. Obviously, I got to have audio decent to where you guys can hear me, but if I've got my hotel room, I didn't even notice that. I got my bed. I didn't even make it. I got my pillows back there. That's incredibly unprofessional. But I can do that with you guys because you know me. You know my content, and you don't come here to see some fancy background or overproduced studio or something. You don't expect that. You just come here for the content, and that's great. But if I want to reach people that don't know who George Gammon is, if I want to reach people that don't understand Austrian economics, just the average Joe and Jane, I've got to step up the content. Because if you shared this video with one of your friends that didn't know me from Adam, they'd watch 30 seconds of this and said, who is this schmuck? This guy's an idiot. This guy's a moron. Look, he's wearing an End the Fed hat and a t-shirt and some crappy hotel room where the bed's not even made. So I get it, right? So I need to step it up, and that's exactly what I'm doing. I've rented space, office space, from my good friend Robert Kiyosaki. I won't say where he's got offices in Scottsdale. I won't say where, but he's got quite a bit of office space where he does his Rich Dad radio show. I'm sure many of you guys are familiar with that. He shoots there. Kim obviously shoots there in the studio. They've got their staff. That's where they do their board meetings and whatnot. And so they've got a few extra offices upstairs that I'm renting. Specifically to set up a studio, make things look professional. And I'm bringing in employees. So work there 9 to 5, Monday through Friday, to where, you know, we're all under one roof, because no matter how neat you think Zoom is or Skype, trust me, I've been an entrepreneur for a long, 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 long time. And, there's nothing that is efficient as working under the same roof as all your employees. That's where you maximize efficiency. So the objective is to create an incredible amount of content daily, that revolves around freedom, liberty, and what's happening with the insane government overreach right now, and then proving to people that what we're dealing with right now has nothing to do with health, nothing, zero. And I'm not here to say that. The cervasive sickness isn't bad. I'm by no means saying that. I'm not saying that the medicine, we'll keep it YouTube friendly, is bad. I'm not saying that either. All I'm saying is that what the government is doing specifically by telling businesses that it is illegal for them to serve a certain group in the population based on the parameters given, it makes no sense. None. Zero. Nada. So if it makes no sense at all, if they're blatantly lying to you, if it's obvious they're lying to you, obviously there's another agenda. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's Big Pharma. I don't know if it's Klaus. I don't know if it's the just crazed politicians. I don't know. But I'm trying to figure it out. And even if I don't know, even if I can spread that message to your friend and family member, Fred, those who are actually receptive to the message, that are looking around them, and they might be a CNN watcher or MSNBC or whatnot, but they know that something's just not right. And if we can just reach those people, that's really, really, really going to move the needle. So that's why I've rented office space. That's why I'm bringing people in. That's why I'm going to allocate 100% of my mental bandwidth and the resources that I have available to fighting for freedom. And really just reaching as many people as we can so that we can make a stand and we can go out to our figurative Berlin Wall, stand up there, and let the central planners know that there's more of us than there is of them. And we are sick and tired. And I'm not condoning violence in any way, shape, or form, but do this peacefully. But let them know that we are sick and tired of their shenanigans, their overreach. And if they want to stay in power, they need to respect personal liberty and freedom, bottom line. And so the point there is I'm still going to talk about macro and all this stuff. And the George Gammon channel will still do whiteboard videos on repo and QE and all the stuff you guys like. But with the Rebel Capitalist channel, really going to make a push toward moving the needle, not only in the United States, but the whole Western world, hopefully the whole world, not just the West, but the East and everywhere. Because people need to wake up. We're at a crossroads. And I feel an incredible sense of urgency right now, as I'm guessing many of you also feel that sense of urgency. And I'm not going to sit back and wait around and just hope this goes away and just assume that this is just temporary. No, that's not going to happen. I'm going to get out there and do everything I can to make sure that we're getting off this road to serfdom and back on to a path to not only maintaining our freedom and liberty, but increasing it. So anyway, another tangent there, I apologize, but I think that's relevant. So you guys know kind of the direction that I'm taking the content on the Rebel Capitalist channel in the future.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Is there anything that would make me get the bananas? I can't answer that, Alex. If the world were to stay as it is now, the answer is no. No. There's no need for me to get it. This, for me personally, the risk-reward doesn't make any sense. Even if you look at the risk-reward that you're hearing from even CNN, you know, or the mainstream media, it still doesn't really make sense for me. So that's not to say that I'm not here to condemn anyone that wants to, you know, get the banana. Listen, everyone's different. Everyone has a different risk profile. Like I said, the risk-reward for every single person is completely different. And that's why it should be a personal decision. Oh, absolutely. 100%. And if someone comes to the conclusion that it makes sense for them to do it, go nuts. Absolutely. Absolutely. I respect your decision. But that doesn't mean it's the right decision for me. And it definitely doesn't mean it's the right decision for a 3-year-old. Right? That's where it really gets bananas, to use your term. But if the world continues to go down this path, and I don't know how they would do it, but if I was left with some sort of horrific decision where I had to make a choice between doing that or like seeing my family again, I'd have to think about it, but I'd probably do it because, you know, that's the same argument that I have against the lockdowns, especially in Australia. It's at what point is life not worth living? Right, look at what they're doing in Australia. You know, all in the name of quote unquote safety. Is it worth it? Is and I know it's a very difficult question, but is saving a few lives really worth turning your entire country into a totalitarian police state? Is that worth it? And what's the end game in Australia? Right? Because I can tell you, you're not going to get rid of the cerveza sickness. It's not going anywhere. I don't care how many people get the bananas or the medicine if people aren't following. This is, Alex is using a term that I used with my buddy Simon Black just to keep it YouTube friendly, but it's the medicine. That's what we're talking about. Yeah, I don't care how many people get it. 100%. Doesn't matter. Do the research. You're not getting rid of it because the medicine doesn't stop transmission. So this is going to be with us forever. For the rest of our lives, it's going to be with us to some degree, right? So what's the end game for Australia? They're playing the game as if they're going to eradicate the cervasis sickness. Not going to happen. They're saying, you know, they're playing this as though, well, we'll just do these lockdowns and we'll just turn ourselves into a totalitarian police state just temporarily until we beat the cervasis sickness, and then we'll go back to life as normal. No. No, you're never going to beat it. It's going to be here forever. So just think about this. So Australia right now, and I don't think they even realize that they've painted themselves into this corner where you've got no way out. Basically, what you're saying is that you are going to lock people in their house and only allow them out for an hour a day for the rest of their lives. Forever. You say, oh, George, oh, that's crazy talk. No, this is just temporary. Really? Because the cervasis sickness isn't temporary. So if you're locking everyone in their house right now and only allowing them out an hour a day due to just the fact that the cervasis sickness exists, well, these parameters are going to be here indefinitely. If your rationale for these lockdowns is XYZ today, XYZ is going to be here tomorrow, it's going to be here in a year, and it's going to be here in 5 years. So the only thing that you can do is A, either maintain your policies indefinitely. That means lock people in a cage and only allow them out an hour a day forever. Or you've got to come to a certain point where you're like, you know what? We're not getting rid of it. We got to bite the bullet. It's going to suck, but there's nothing we can do. We'll try to get the bananas to as many people as we can, but these lockdowns, we've got to get back to living our life. And you've got to kind of rip off the figurative Band-Aid, so to speak. And my guess, my hope, is that they'll get to that point. Now, whether that's a year, whether that's 5 years, who knows? Who knows? Remember, this was supposed to be just 2 weeks to flatten the curve. If back then I would have said to anyone that this is going to last 2 years or a year and a half or whatever, what would people have said back then? Oh, you're a conspiracy theorist. You're a tinfoil hatter. The government's not going to do that. You're just fear-mongering. So if it's gone a year and a half to 2 years, why can't it go another 2 years? Why can't it go another 5 years? And I'm not talking about the cervasis sickness. That's going to be here forever. I'm talking about the lockdowns and the draconian measures. So at some point, if they say, okay, we got to rip the Band-Aid off, this is just, we're not going to beat it. So let's just try to do the best with what we've got, but we've got to allow people to actually leave the house and to live their lives. Well, you might as well do that now, right? Is it better to do that now and just say it is what it is? Or is it better to do that in 5 years when you've completely destroyed the economy, when you've ruined people's lives, when you've quite literally turned them into Howard Hughes? Think about the hypochondriacs that you are creating right now. You're creating an entire country of Howard Hughes. Think about what that does to kids. These kids that are a year, 2 years old right now, that are having, you know, heaven forbid, but the parents put masks on them and they're seeing their parents go to jail or being handcuffed for not wearing a mask outside. And their parents are telling them that other human beings are dirty and filthy and spreading disease. And what's the probabilities that those kids grow up to be hypochondriacs? Besides 100%, right? Think about the long-term psychological damage that you're doing to people. And especially if you lock them in a cage for another 5 years or another 2 years or whatever it is. Ironically enough, all in the name of safety and health, right? So you get what I'm saying. That's the corner that the Australian government has painted themselves into. And that's what we could see here in the United States if we don't get out and stand up for our freedom. That's how important it is right now. And that just goes back to what we were saying before as far as, you know, but going back to your bananas question, Alex, you know, if I was out of the country, let's say, and when I was out of the country, they just, you know, had an executive order really quick to get back in the country, I'd have to take the bananas. And I knew that if I didn't, I would never see my family again unless I flew them out. And if they left, then they can't come back in. I mean, I don't know. That's a situation that we may face in the future, and I can't give you an answer on that. Most likely, I'd take it because my family is just too important to me, and regardless of the risk reward, it just doesn't matter. Because again, why is life worth living? Right? Think about the things that makes it worth living, and if all of that is taken away, you can have all the security and health and safety in the world, but it's just not worth it. Yeah, this is a good question. So thoughts on the lemming theory. Most have an instinct to follow the crowd, so they won't stand up ever dwindling freedom, even if they want to. Most follow government until food isn't available. Yeah, well, that's a good point. And I think that may even be applicable to a lot of the politicians. I asked myself the question, how on earth can this whole thing be worldwide? Like, how can these lockdowns and these draconian measures be worldwide? It just boggles my mind. And I think if you're a politician and your only goal is to keep your job, it's very similar to being an analyst on Wall Street during the housing bubble prior to the GFC. What would happen is if you rated all these mortgage-backed securities as AAA or a safe product, then you would be in with the group of sheeple. Or the lemmings. And even if you're wrong, as long as every other lemming is wrong, you're not going to lose your job. But where you risk losing your job is when you go outside of the herd. If you leave the group of lemmings and have a different opinion, that's where you risk losing your job. And I think because of the insane world that we live in right now, the politicians, and I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt right now, but assuming that they're reasonably ethical and they don't have malicious intent, assuming that, I'm not going to say they have good character because I think very, very few politicians do. But assuming that they're not just sociopaths that are just under the influence of the World Economic Forum, I think they're just looking around them saying, hey, I want to keep my job. I want to be reelected. And even if I'm wrong with these draconian measures or restrictions that we're taking for the cerveza sickness, as long as everyone else is doing them, all the other countries around me are doing them, and the US or you know, the UK or whatever, as long as those big countries are doing them, then even if I'm wrong with the medicine or the bananas or anything like that, I'm most likely not going to get fired because everyone else is doing it. All the other politicians are doing the exact same thing. And they're not going to change their tune until we get to a point where the politicians realize that, wait a minute here, I need to be correct. I can't just be a part of the herd, because if I'm not correct, even if I'm part of the herd, I'm not going to get my job. I'm not going to get reelected. And that's the message that we have to send to these people ASAP. All right, guys, I got to hop on my member live stream, so I'm going to have to skip the shout outs. I really, 1,200 people, that's fantastic. Really appreciate you guys hanging out with me on this Sunday night. We got a fight ahead of us, guys, but I'm here. I'm here for battle. I'm going to stand up for freedom. Hopefully you guys will join me. All of you rebel capitalists out there, have a fantastic rest of your weekend, and I'll see you in the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.